Hey, this is Stan Lynch from the Speaker Wars. You're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
To be. This is small town music. This is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away, a song away, a song away.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis. Joining me in the Zoom room to promote the release of The Speaker Wars debut studio album, please welcome drummer, songwriter, and producer, Stan Lynch. How you doing, Stan?
I'm well. How about you?
I am doing great. Now, I'm in Los Angeles currently. Where are you located?
Well, first, let me just take a beat right there. How are you with LA and everything right now? How you been?
Well, let me tell you something. My wife and I moved to North Carolina 6 weeks ago. We're from Los Angeles. We're just back here for 5 days to visit. And we're about 4 miles from the epicenter last night. And that was a nice welcome home for sure.
Wow. I really feel, I did 20 years in Los Angeles and loved the place. And my heart goes out to all y'all out there, you know, that's.
Yeah.
But I'm in an undisclosed location in mid-central Florida out in the woods.
Your music room looks incredible.
Oh, it's a good spot. Yeah, over the years, I've had this place out here since probably 1980, you know? I mean, since I was a boy, when the band started to do well, I immediately went back to find my roots in Florida. I'm from here, and I love it here. Central Florida is very different than South Florida. North Florida is different countries. And it's pretty remote, and I've got a good spot and built this studio a couple of years back. Had several on the property that I've done over years, but this has been fun. It's been really, I love making music, man. I got no choice.
you can't not do it.
Thank goodness. If I couldn't make music, there'd probably be a bounty on my head by now. Yeah.
With that hat on, you look like the bad guy right now.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe that's good. I don't know.
It's good. It's good, Stan. First of all, before we get going, I want to let everyone know where they can find everything about the Speaker Wars. TheSpeakerWars.com, Facebook.com/TheSpeakerWarsMusic, and Instagram @TheSpeakerWarsOfficial. So, if you don't know anything about Stan and his new band, this is where you're going to find out everything. The album is the debut, and it will be released May 30th, I assume, on all formats, even vinyl. Who knows?
Yeah, we did definitely. The company, a great company, very, very, they're very detail-oriented. They made great vinyl. I mean, this isn't just some kind of, you know, like half-ass, hope we did some good vinyl. These guys are meticulous, and they did beautiful digital work on the CD and the vinyl, which they were actually finding errors before I could, which is hard to do. And I'm very grateful to them and grateful to everybody that helped us put this project together. It really requires a lot of energy from a lot of people to make something happen, and including you and your listeners. Thank you.
Well, and look, everyone I know is a big Stan Lynch fan. We loved you during the heyday of the Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers band, and all the way through your work with Don Henley and just everything you've done. And we're going to talk about it, but I do want to focus on this band first. Stan, is this your band, or were you invited to join this band?
A little of both. I mean, you know, like I kind of say, D, all of the above. It's like John Davis is the singer. And the other, you know, he's a principal in this group. And all the guys in the group had played with John for years in Texas. And, you know, I sort of had a belly full of bands when I, you know, after my tenure. And it became a kind of a running joke with John to say, like, man, you need to join our band, man. You need to get in here. And get busy and get your old job back. And I'm like, no. And it was COVID that created a lot of that energy, oddly enough, for a lot of guys, because you could only sit on your ass so long and you thought you were melting, you know, like, so you figured, well, let's get to work. Let's learn to file share. Let's do a whole nother way of recording and writing. And that's really how the project started coming together, was actually during COVID, oddly enough. It motivated a whole different way of making music for a lot of people, not just me.
And it changed this podcast for me. All my guests used to be in person in a studio, face to face with me. And after COVID, it's all on Zoom, but it's great because then I can talk to guys that are across the country like you are right now.
Yeah. I mean, that was quite a moment when we were all burning our groceries and setting fire to, our bedding, and we didn't know, we really didn't know. And, the upside of it was that I learned a lot more of the technical aspect of file sharing and recording and working. And it was the years of working with Jeff Lynn that actually taught me, because Jeff is a one at a time kind of recording guy. He doesn't really like to record bands. He likes to record individuals, make a composite. And what I rebelled against during that time was an education, and I drew on a lot of that. So I've been very fortunate to be an amalgam of all these cool things that I've been privy to, that even at the time I thought they were sort of akin to torture. And now you go like, oh, that's cool. I learned something. I can apply this. And I think that's what it's all about, is my continuing education. You know, I never want to stop. I never want to stop.
Let me ask you this, Stan. During the recording of Into the Great Wide Open, then, are you telling me that you guys weren't necessarily in the room together as a band all the time?
Rarely. I mean, if at all.
Well, I started out down a dirty road. Started out all alone, and the sun went down as I crossed the hill, and the town lit up, the world got still. I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down is the hardest thing.
I mean, I think what I took away from Jeff's process is that he didn't have a lot of faith in a band being able to come together and make that sound. He had a very specific sound in mind. He was an architect.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when an architect designs a building, you don't just bring in a bunch of boneheads and say like, hey man, we'll build what we want to build. He is very specific. And I said, that process was horrifying at the time. But like I said, I'm so thrilled that I took away something from that. So I'm very grateful.
That's a good thing, because a lot of people wouldn't have taken away anything. They would have rebelled so much that they would have been dismissive of that process. So good on you.
Well, those people are probably small-minded ultimately, and they're probably afraid of growth or change. And that's a very easy position to take. When you're uncomfortable, your first thought is, well, screw that, man. I don't need to learn that. I got my thing. And but the better man goes, oh, I'm uncomfortable. Shit, I'm fixing to learn something. You know, it's like, so I my work with Henley and Korchmar, I was very uncomfortable in those rooms, because those guys are way out in front of me, generationally even. I mean, I'm not that they're that much older, but they've made music so much longer than me. And there were moments when I would be in the room, I'd go like, this shit is going way over my head. You know, I got to stand up. This is hardcore, and I can't rebel. I have to just go, man, let me go home and do my homework. Let me learn. And so I've been schooled by almost every project I've ever been in, you know, of any caliber. I've been schooled, and I come home just going, holy shit, didn't see that one coming. And this is good. So I feel like I'm getting a good library.
Your work with Don Henley really amazes me because it's so good. And I feel like that is, and you can tell me, but as an outsider, I feel like Don might be the person that you were most connected with as a collaborator. I kind of feel like he might have recognized talent in you that maybe Tom never did.
Wasn't needed, you know, let's be honest. I mean, I could take it personal with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, but we had a great songwriter.
Absolutely. 100%. No denying it.
Yeah. And it was, look, all humility aside, that was a very good rock and roll band. I mean, you could put us out with just about anybody. And my takeaway was these guys were fingers on a fist. We could make a beautiful noise. So I wasn't needed. What that band quote needed was a drummer, you know, and a guy who could sing background vocals. And so I was happy to fit in. And they were a little older than me, and I was always trying to be pleased. I wanted to impress them. And that was part of the charm of being in that band. We were trying to knock each other's socks off. And we usually did. With Don, it was a very different experience because I met him later. And he was gracious. He opened the door. You don't knock on Don Henley and Dan Korsmeyer's door and go, hey, man, I want to work with you. It doesn't work. These are invitation only rooms. And I was invited in probably with a little skepticism, I'm sure. And I was allowed to serve an apprenticeship while they made, I was there for Don's second album. And in the process, Cooch would say, hey, if you got anything to contribute, if you got something. And so they let me earn my way in, which was really cool. And Don has been a real big brother to my, he basically sponsored my second act.
Well, I mean, the third album, The End of the Innocence, it sells 6 million copies and you have 3 co-writes on that. I imagine that, turns into some mailbox money for you.
Yes, but what it really did was it gave me a second name. Like,
yeah,
you know, it gave me like, oh, I can actually. It granted me license. You
mm-hmm.
know, he gave me credibility, and I had written a lot of stuff before, but being able to audit Don's process and learning how he does things, which is very specific. He's earned that right. And he does it that way. And being allowed to experience that is a man, like I said, for love nor money, you don't get that unless he says, in here, boy, come on.
Just melts. Looking like if you had your wish, you'd be somewhere else.
But your role with working with Don Henley, it increased with every album. Inside Job, you co-wrote 9 of the 13 tracks. Cass County, it's written and produced by Don Henley and Stan Lynch. And one of my favorite songs on that album is Take a Picture of This.
Long, long time ago, when we were young and pretty, we ruled the world, we stopped the time. City, running with the crowd, yeah, free and proud. I heard somebody say, take a picture of this. Ooh, take a picture of this. The years went rushing by in the twinkling of an eye.
So he really believed in you and he really did see something in you. And the first time I saw your name on Building a Perfect Beast as a songwriter, I was like, hey, that's Stan from the Heartbreakers. It was a cool thing to see you involved in all of that work for me as a fan.
Well, thank you. Believe me, I have the same experience. Like people will say to me, man, when I heard American Girl, it was blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, hey, I heard it the first time too. it freaked me out. You know what I mean? To hear Mike Campbell do what he did. And so I was just as freaked out when I heard like Last Worthless Evening on the radio. I mean, I'm just as excited. I'm certainly not jaded by all of this experience that I've had. I'm thrilled and I have so much gratitude for being able to do this. I mean, like I said, the other job I'm probably qualified for is, would you like fries with that? You know,
I don't believe that, Stan, but okay. Let me ask you this. You brought up American Girl. When you're sitting in a movie theater watching Silence of the Lambs and American Girl comes pumping through the theater, that must have been a thrill for sure.
Well, it was an interesting scene.
It's a very interesting scene.
Like, uh-oh, you know, it's like we kind of got, you know, we're in the snuff portion of the film, you know? You're always kind of tickled. And now it's so completely out of body because those songs are so old. They're almost baked into the atmosphere. I mean, shoot, I'm shopping for peas at Publix and I'll hear, you know, Last Dance with Mary Jane or all, you know, it's weird. You know, I go to sit down and it's sometimes my friends they go, are you being punked? Cause the minute we sit down, something will come on. And I go like, I swear I didn't tip the guy, you know, I didn't pay him, you know? But it's an honor to have these songs last so long. And my contribution to be, acknowledged and I'm grateful to all the guys that anybody I've ever worked with that's put up with me. It's fantastic. You know,
Can I ask this? Because whenever I would see you in a band photo, you seem to tower over the other Heartbreakers. How tall of a man are you, Stan?
Well, in my prime, I was 6'3", I'm probably close to that now. I haven't shrunk much, but yeah, I was always too tall. But you know, like the only other drummer I remember being this tall was Mick Fleetwood.
Yeah, yeah. You guys look like you're playing behind like a child's kit.
It's interesting when I met Mick. It was like he's probably bigger than me.
Yeah.
And I have a theory about drummers that are ectomorphs. You know, that have these long arms and legs. That we play a little lazy because the signal takes long to get there. I just have it feels like we can't help it. It's like, by the time I tell my hand to do something, it's got a long way to go. And I think that's part of what creates a certain, the way you play. It's like, you know, every drummer, every musician has a biorhythm. You know, they have a place, like every drummer sits down and plays something almost every time that only they really feel, you know, they really feel it in their heart. And my biorhythm is usually sort of blues based, mid-tempo. I don't really enjoy playing fast because it's a lot of work. So, and you know, I noticed that stouter dudes on the drums, man, they can really get up on it, you know? So I think being tall is a plus and a minus when you're a drummer. I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either, but I love it. I love you and I love Mick Fleetwood. So what are you going to do?
Me too. Well, Mick Fleetwood's right up there in the, you know, he's on my Mount Rushmore. You know, he's right there. You know,
yeah. And he's as tall as Mount Rushmore. So
he's a badass mofo, man. The reason why they named a band after him, you know?
Yeah. let's not forget all the other members of the Speaker Wars. We got J. Michael Smith on guitar, Brian Patterson on bass.
Yes.
Steve Ritter on percussion and Jay Brown on keyboards. We got six guys in the band. The first single that you guys released is You Make Every Lie Come True. And when that harmonica kicks in, it definitely brings up comparisons to some classic Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers for me. Mm. I mean, that song for me is the one that most sounds like your former bandmates. But I love it.
I'm gonna rock like Johnny Cash. I'm gonna stand on the Grand Ole Opry, sing my songs while the cameras flash. I'm gonna live to see 100. I'm gonna age like a fine French wine.
All of this is, I wish I could tell you there was premeditation in any of this.
I'm sure there's not.
Well, I'm not capable. I mean, if somebody were to say, you know, that's like saying, write a hit. It's like,
right.
You know, and I have no affinity for what is contemporary. I have no clue. I never did. I really didn't. I mean, to my credit or whatever, it was like, when you're in a band, you're in a biosphere. That's what you do. That's what you listen to. That's who you create with. And that's what I get to do with this new band. This is my train I'm on. Other guys in the band have more of a tendency to try to school me in what's happening in the music business. And I still have a passionate disinterest for almost everything, you know, that it like if I discover it organically, if it touches me, then I'm interested. But if you played something for me and go, this is a big hit today, this is what everybody's, I'm like, if it didn't reach me, I don't know. I guess I've shot past all that, you know?
The songs on this album, 10 tracks, were these written by committee? Are these all, cause I don't have the album credits in front of me, even though I've been listening to the album for a week and a half now. Were these written by committee? Were they written already when you joined? What's the songwriting process for the Speaker Wars?
This particular album was John and I.
Okay.
We had met in Nashville earlier in a previous, when we were both staff writers at different publishers. Okay. We met on a blind date. It went terribly, not for us, but he was going to make a record. I was slated to produce it. They pitched us songs that I thought were horrible. I spoke up. We got fired. It was perfect. And it, rather than John beat my ass, he put his arms around me. He said, man, you took up for me. Thank you. And so we built a bond. John and I, basically, we wrote these songs. We wrote a bunch of, we got a basket of songs. Once we determined that we were going to do a band, I let it go to committee of which of the songs would make the record. And that's where this, our exec, Mike Pastorzi, stepped in. He built the assembly of what he thought was a good first album. There's a mechanical element to building a record. If you just release a song on Spotify, it's not that hard. Making an actual album requires mastering and assembly, and that's where Mike stepped in and did a great job just getting this thing organized. And I feel like this record is definitely a first record. I'm really hoping there's more, because there's a lot more in the tank. You know, there really is. There's a lot more in both of us. And the band is contributing now too, as we've been practicing. I'm seeing their strengths. I'm seeing what they, and these guys have all been around. They can all play, you know, they're all got an opinion.
Yeah. When you're putting an album together, you have to sequence it correctly too. It has to flow as a single piece of art. And I've been listening to this top to bottom. I just didn't like jump around. I've been given track one to track 10 over and over to get a feel of it. And, you know, great. I mean, great job. What else can I say? You guys did it. I named the six members of the band, but on the song, The Forgiveness Tree, I hear some background vocals that don't sound like some gentlemen. Who are the background vocals on that track?
Those are John's. John has a cartel of great players that he plays with in Texas, in Dallas. That's Maylee. She's great. There's a cast and crew of all kinds of, there's some goofy, it's wonderful. Like, we really were scrappy, and people contributed willingly. You know, we didn't, like, if we would, you know, John would play stuff for his friends and they go, well, man, I can try that. Or so it was very organic and very loose. So there's all kinds of fun little moments in this record. I said it's a fine line now when you make demos today. They are almost records now.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a good DAWs, if you're decent and you know how to record at home, and there's very few budgets to go in and make albums. You know, who has that kind of, you know, that, forget it. So everybody had to be, you have to learn to be pretty ghetto and scrappy, and you learn to, and what's cool is there's no elitism in it. Like in the old days, if you were, you know, if you had a huge budget and you're at A&M Records, there's only so many people at A&M that day. You're going to run into, now in this world, I'm running into everybody. I'm running into people I probably wouldn't normally cross paths with, but it's an equal playing field. It's very democratic now when you make music. We all have the same right to the same equipment. We all own guitars. And if you're a track guy, you're a programming fool. And if you're a guy who likes live music, hey man, I might have a slight advantage having played, you know, all those bars and all those gigs. I have a slight advantage of knowing what it could be, that maybe someone who didn't do what I did, you know, I can see around the corners, I can see up ahead and kind of go, you know, but I love the process now. It's very, it's liberating. It's just liberating, you know.
Thank you.
and rewarding when you, you know, when you get songs like this down and you hear the final mixes. I'm sure it just it blows your mind and takes you right back to your youth.
It's very similar. This record has a similar, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not catch as catch can.
Yeah.
Like first record we did with the Heartbreakers was the same way. Like, hey, we're going to cut one song in Tulsa. We're going to cut one song over here. We're going to do one with this weird thing that Mike started. So the formula is it's a madhouse. It's uranium 235. Who knows what's going to happen? And any, you know, bring it, let's go, follow your bliss. And at the end of a couple of days, you go back and listen and go, okay, there's bones or far out. Don't touch it. You know? So I find the whole thing and having guys like the Speaker Wars around me is very liberating because they're encouraging guys, you know, I may get a little salty with it and go, man, it could be this, it could be that. And they're like, dude, let's go. You know, what are you waiting on? You know? So
I feel like Stan Lynch always speaks up.
Yeah. That ain't a gift. It's a,
you brought up Mike Campbell. I sure want to mention that you got to play some gigs with Mike a while back. You sat in with the Dirty Knobs for some shows. Did that experience help propel you to get back behind the drums for the Speaker Wars, or was the Speaker Wars already moving along at that point?
All of it conspired to make me feel a little more at home. I hadn't played the drums publicly in decades, literally.
Yeah. You know,
so I had moved on totally. And a lot of things conspired. I was looking to play drums in general on, you know, I started playing drums on my own stuff, on the Speaker Wars stuff, and I was playing around the house. And Greg Bissonette, who's a fantastic drummer.
Oh my gosh, so good. I just saw him with Ringo last year.
Oh yeah, you know, he's Ringo's drummer. What does that tell you?
I know, what's that tell you?
Yeah, Greg, I was talking to Greg one day and I said, look, I'm playing more drums. And he goes, man, you know, I got to hook you up. I got this company, Dixon, they're fantastic. And I'm like, oh, yeah, great. So he designed me a drum set a few years ago. And that really re-inspired me. You know, matter of fact, they're right there. There they are.
So, there they are.
But Greg has always been in my corner. You know, he's always been like, Stan, play this, do that. And taught me things over the years that takes, you know, he teaches a drum lesson from Greg is 3 years for me. One hour with Greg, I'm working 3 years. So that's no bullshit. That's for real.
Oh, I know. I followed his career ever since he was with David Lee Roth way back.
Me too. I remember going to see David. I heard about this. Myron Grombacher, another great drummer, said, you need to go see this kid who's playing with David Lee Roth. So I go there and, you know, David Lee Roth is great. It's, you know, but I never took my eyes off of Greg the whole night. Yeah. I'm just, whoever this guy is, this is another planet. Then he turns out he's a lovely guy. And he's been, so he got me playing these good drums. He built me a drum set. And then when Mike called, I was kind of already ready. And then getting together with Mike was so familiar, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, that didn't hurt. And then the audience, playing for Mike's audience, they were really kind to me, so that didn't hurt, you know. And all of it, and Mike's crew, it takes a village, man. Everybody involved, for me, usually 99% of the time, are really kind, good spirits, and that creates momentum for me, you know. A couple assholes and you can kind of just go home, you know?
But, right.
You know, so I got to spend a couple of months with Mike, and his drummer's great. Matt Logg is playing with AC/DC now.
Yeah.
You know, so, stepping in for Matt was, that was no light trick either, you know, cause I never learned anybody's charts. You know, I'm like that guy. I only learned how to play like me. Trying to play Matt's stuff was, that was an eye opener too, because you go, oh, these guys are good, man. He's good.
So. And Mike has his autobiography coming out pretty soon. Is there a book in Stan Lynch's future?
There probably is, but it's you know, it was hard enough to do it the first time. You know, it's like I don't know if I could relive it. It's it was wonderful to do once. You know,
yeah.
I don't have any regrets that I should go back and try to. And plus, I think when you, in the telling of a story, there's revisionist history and you got to be very careful.
Yeah.
Like, what happened? I mean, look, any event with, I mean, I think the best interview would be if we could get all the remaining Heartbreakers, the original guys are still alive, get them all in a room and ask a question. And I guarantee you get four different answers.
Yeah. Well, that's like at the end of this interview, I'm going to tell people it was great and you're going to tell people it sucked. So, I mean, that's just how it
works. No, I won't. Worked. I won't.
I'm kidding, Stan.
I know, but I know what you're saying. It can be, yeah. What is it? That metaphor of five guys touching an elephant and
yeah,
guy feels the trunk and convinced he's got a snake and the other guy's touching this. And it's, I mean, but rock and roll by its nature happens without much planning and you don't know what's going to happen and yeah. You're young and you're impressionable and you're desperate and you process things at different rates. Like Tom processed fame and power and money a lot quicker than I'll ever be. I'm still working on all that, you yeah. know, like, but he processed it and it was very impressive. And I watched the other guys in the band process it. Benmont was, who's brilliant as a human being, not to mention, he's just, is a piano player, but he's a very bright man. He was processing things too. We weren't dumb guys. I mean, so you're trying to understand what's happening, but it's happening to you, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of shock. It's like waking up and seeing a big arrow in your chest and trying to understand what just happened while you're surviving and trying to get the damn thing out and then figure out how to do it again. So it was a lot of hectic energy. Those for my 20 years, you know, that I did with the band was extremely hectic and I'm so grateful for it. But I could have never done that last 20 and I'm so proud of them that they did it, but that was not for me.
Well, I also feel like the 20 years that you were there, it was go, 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 go. And then after you were gone, they were still going, but it felt like a little bit more of a normal pace, if that's even possible in rock and roll.
Well, they were adults.
Yes, that's the, yeah, you have families, you have kids, you have all those other responsibilities.
And the limitations of your physical body.
Right, yeah, it's different.
I hate to break it to anybody younger than me. There's a cumulative overuse factor.
Yeah.
In playing good rock and roll. And for the drums, it's a very physical, there's a very physical component to playing good rock and roll.
Yeah. The drummer is often the first one to go because it's so physical.
Well, you throw your body at the fire to keep the fire going, you know?
Right.
So what's that great look, that burning thing? That's you burning up, you know? So but it's wonderful when you're young and dumb. You just throw yourself at this stuff and you do it repeatedly. I mean, you know, 6 nights a week usually, or 7 even. And it isn't until you grow up that, you know, and that's the part I'm sort of glad I missed, was that where it became like, you know, we can only do 2 shows in a row and we got to take 3 days off. And
yeah,
I missed all that. It was
right.
It was just like, I was a dragster. I got to get down to, you know.
And Stan, I appreciate you answering all these questions from your entire career. And I know people are going to ask you questions like this, but so I'm just going to keep getting back to the speaker wars. I want to talk about the song Leave Him. I mean, I love this one. I mean, this is, in my life, this is something we've seen a million times. An amazing woman who stays with a man who is completely not worthy of her company. And this song, Leave Him, just nailed that for me. Loved it.
She's a penny, he's a train. She's blue sky, he's the rain. Such a shame. She's a tire, he's a nail. She's the windshield, he's the hail. He never fails to ever treat her right. I don't know why she tries. Help me solve the mystery, why someone who is sweet as she believes in, she should just leave him. Baby, you're so right for me. You're everything I'll ever need. You don't need him.
Well, thanks for pointing that out. That's really cool. I got a soft spot in my heart for that song too. I mean, it was very personal, you know, when it was in my mind, I knew who I was writing that to. And, but then John, you know, he was probably writing it to someone else. And that was really fun. And we both love old school country music. We love old school R&B. You know, we're weird that way. Like we really love Buck Owens. We love all of that. I mean, so Leave Him for me was just a, like a Everly's, I love all that. You know, I love doing the harmony with him. And it was, I think it's a cool song. I hope it connects with people. I think it could.
I hope it does too. Cause I really love the message and it painted a picture for me. And I just thought it was a great one. That was one of many standouts on the album.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you for listening and thank you for noticing that. That's cool. In a world, I mean, so much music comes out. I mean, I realize that, man, there's so much that you got to cut through, like for this band, even cut through the chatter, like, and I even tell my friends who like me, look, if you can find the time to listen to it, you know, all the way through, because we're so ADD. I still carry a flip phone just for that reason. You know, here, proof. I'm not kidding.
There it is.
You know, it's because I can't text. I can't. I'm incapable, and I hate this multitasking world we're in. I love, you know, and I was told, nobody even puts out records anymore or albums. And I'm like, well, screw it. I want to, you know, and
yeah.
If a couple people buy into it, that's great. But I realized that the world, man, we churn and burn so fast now.
Well, I did like that you guys kept it to 10 songs, because sometimes when a new project comes out, they want to overload me with 14, 16 tracks. And how am I supposed to get into that album and into that music if it's so many tracks? 10 is perfect for me. I'm old school. I think about albums, 5 songs on a side. And so you can sit with this record and you can get into it when it's 10 songs. So thank you.
No, I appreciate that. I have the same experience. People will lay stuff on me and I'll look at it and go, oh crap, there's 24 songs. There's almost dread.
Yeah, there's dread.
It's like, I'm going to play it. I'm going to go, oh crap, who's got the 3 hours? And I love some of these people, but I'm like you said, I'm from the old school too. Like side A had 4 or 5. And I mean, I think we put out the second Petty record was like 26 minutes of music or something.
Yeah.
I think we realized it when we got, it was like, oh wow, this record's really short. Or, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but it was, I remember like, wow, there's, oh yeah, well, the songs are 2 minutes and 28 seconds, you know, fine.
Yeah.
I hope that we have a greatest hits record that runs 3 hours long.
That would be fantastic. With the re-releasing of some of the back Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers catalog, like recently Long After Dark, do you get a copy of that? And are you listening to the bonus tracks and reliving the memories, or are you just, that was in the past and you're looking towards the future?
Yeah, I mean, I look at it, and
yeah.
I don't really need to hear certain songs. They're tattooed, you know.
Right, right.
I know
sure.
What's going to happen. There's very few surprises in the old songs, but then they'll burp out something that was an outtake or of another version, and I'll be curious, you know, like. Mm-hmm. But I don't spend a lot of time. If I do listen to the old stuff, I listen now with different ears. I don't listen to me. I listen to Ben, or I listen to Mike, or I listen to Ron, or how I listen to, I get into their head. And it's really a nice, because I was so up my own butt when we were making those records. You know, it was me. I'm worried. What am I going to, oh God, what am I going to do? How, you know, you're so consumed. Sometimes I wouldn't even hear the song until we played it for a day. Then I'd go, oh, right, yeah. There's a big picture here. So now I can listen to some of the old stuff now and really hear what Ben's doing. And I go, man, it's better than even I remember, you know? So there's a few surprises in it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Long After Dark for me, I loved it when it came out, but as the years have ticked by, that one keeps moving up to the top of my fave Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers albums. I really enjoy that album a lot. Another track on the Speaker Wars that I love is When the Moon Cries Wolf, and John sounds like Don Henley on this track. Like I'm hearing so much of the other artists that you used to work with and still do on some of these tracks. And I think it's just happening organically. I don't think John is trying to sound like Don Henley, but man, that gives me a Henley feel. And I love it, When the Moon Cries Wolf. So good.
Every night it's the same old thing. She come dancing in and out my dreams. In the silver light, she's crystal clear. I reach for her, she's not there. I see her body in the soft moonlight. Curves are plenty, high and tight. Oh, to feel that heat again. I feel those fingers digging in. When the moon cries wolf. When the moon cries wolf. When the moon cries wolf.
When the moon cries wolf.
Cries wolf.
Cries wolf.
Hear the howl and lose my will. Learn to run, kill or be killed. Her memory.
It's a great, I don't think there's a question in there, but the statement is lovely. And the compliment is huge. I mean, you know, Don is, will always be the high bar for me, you know, and I sometimes he's sitting on my shoulder when I'm working in spirit going like, you know, that's not that good, Stan. Or he's saying to me like, you got better, buddy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because that's, Don is extremely tough on himself. And therefore, he expects anyone in his orbit to give it everything you got. And that's what I learned from him. And I'm passing that on to people that want to work with me.
Yeah.
If you want to be in the room with me, don't say that was pretty good, because that ain't what I'm going for. I'm going for the best you can do today, everything, even if it means you just leave, you pass out and leave blood on the floor. I want everything you got. And that's Don on my shoulder going like, is this really the best we can do? You know, it's like, so I learned a lot from him. So a song like that, maybe, yeah, I mean, it's not conscious, but there's pieces of me, all the people I've worked with that were good, there's pieces of me recycling, you know, I'm a synthesizer, yeah, just like everyone else.
In 2000, Don's album Inside Job came out, and the song I'm Taking You Home went to number one on the U.S. Adult Contemporary charts.
All in this love, I found strength. Never knew I had. And this love is like nothing I have ever.
That came out right around the time my first child was born, and we were taking our child home from the hospital. So that song has a whole different meaning for me. When I hear I'm Taking You Home, it just takes me back to, you know, your life is changing because you're bringing a child into your home. And I know that's not what the song's about, but for me, when I hear it, that's how my interpretation of it is.
And that's what it's about.
All right. And I love that song.
No, I mean, that
makes
whole
me cry.
With Don, it's a very, his process, I think, is he's a very private person, but this is his public offering. When he makes a record, I sense, I'm not sure if this is true, but this is as much of an insight as you'll get into who he is and what he's going through. And So I'm very reverent when Don comes in with a lyric that he feels strong enough to go to a microphone and sing. I'm very protective. I'm like, well, this is as close as I'm going to ever get to reading his diary.
Right. You
know, it's a very, like I said, he's very private, and rightfully so. And so when he sings, you're learning something about him. And I think that that's what a good producer should always, that should be his number one job, is to look at his artists and say, did this do what you wanted it to do? And I do that with John.
Yeah.
John's my singer, or, you know, he's the singer, not my singer. But I literally look at, he's just learning to take stock of that power. Like, hey, John, is this what you want? And he's confused, because he's like, well, what do you think? And I'm like, wrong answer. You know, it's like, wrong answer, man. Is this your statement? And if it's not, get out of here and come back when you're ready to make one. So we're evolving into a place where we can talk in shorthand now. You know, it's getting better. But with Don, that took a long time for him to trust anyone in the room, let alone me. Like, are you guys going to mishandle my offering? You know, are you going to drop this thing, or make it more of a statement, that make it more about you, or what drum sound, or like, the hell with it. This is the vocal is your North Star.
Yeah. Well, look, everybody, here's the deal. The Speaker Wars is coming out on May 30th. And if you want to know everything about the Speaker Wars, go to thespeakerwars.com. I'm so happy that Stan Lynch is coming back. We're going to get to go out and see him drum live. Love your drumming, Stan. I always have. And my final question, it might be easy, it might be difficult. I always ask the artist to choose a playout song from the new album. And that's what we'll use as our playout song for this episode. And it can be anyone. We could have talked about it already, or it can be one we didn't mention. What do you got for me?
Wow. I don't know. Go out with the first song. Like, let's start at the top. Let's go out with You Make Every Like I'm True.
All right.
Let's go chronological. Next time we talk, we'll do the second one.
All right. Everybody, pre-order this album, buy it, stream it. But I say buy it. Don't stream it. Buy it. And everyone, please enjoy You Make Every Lie Come True. Thank you, Stan, for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're very kind. I appreciate it, too. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm gonna rock like Johnny Cash. I'm gonna stand on the Grand Ole Opry, sing my songs while the cameras flash. I'm gonna live to see 100. I'm gonna age like a fine French wine. We're gonna dance like Fred and Ginger. I'll provide like Don Corleone. You'll have a yacht the size of Texas. We'll make love on the moon. Hey, there's nothing we can't do.
I'm checking the clock. They told me to keep it at a half hour, which I will. And here we go.
Yeah, I've just got to, they've got me scheduled for another one in about an hour. But if we creep a little bit and we're having fun, you know, don't lose your mind.
Well, I like that. Okay, here we go.